except when it was too late to profit by it. With the timidity of my age was united that of a very loving disposition, always troubled by the fear of displeasing. Besides, although my mind was tolerably well formed, I had never seen the world, and was entirely wanting in manners, and my knowledge, far from supplementing this defect, only served to intimidate me still more by making me feel how sadly I needed them. Fearing, therefore, that my first appearance would not prejudice Madame de Varennes in my favour, I had recourse to other expedients. I composed a beautiful letter, in oratorical style, in which, intermingling phrases out of books with the language of an apprentice, I displayed all my eloquence in order to gain her goodwill. I enclosed Monsieur de Pontvert's letter in my own, and set out for the dreaded interview. Madame de Varennes was not at home. I was told that she had just gone to church. It was Palm Sunday in 1728. I ran after her. I saw her. I overtook her. I addressed her. I ought to remember the spot. Since then I have often wetted it with my tears and covered it with my kisses. I should like to surround this happy spot with a railing of gold. I should like to draw upon it the homage of the world. Whoever loves to honour the monuments of the salvation of men should only approach them on his knees. It was in a passage behind her house, leading between a brook on the right, which separated the house from the garden, and the court wall on the left, through a back gate to the Franciscan church. Les Cordeliers, a religious order founded by St. Francis of Assisi in 1223. The name was afterwards also given to a club founded in 1790 by Danton, Marat, and Desmoulins, which held its meetings in the old Franciscan convent at Paris. Just as she was going to enter, Madame de Varennes, hearing my voice, turned round. How did the sight of her strike me? I had pictured to myself an old, grim, religious enthusiast. In my opinion, Monsieur de Pontvert's pious lady could be nothing else. Instead, I beheld a face full of charm, beautiful blue eyes full of gentleness, a dazzling complexion, the outlines of an enchanting throat. Nothing escaped the rapid glance of the young proselyte, for at that moment I became hers, feeling convinced that a religion preached by such apostles must inevitably lead to paradise. With a smile she took the letter which I presented to her with a trembling hand, opened it, glanced at that of Monsieur de Pontvert, returned to mine, read it through, and would have read it again had not her servant reminded her that it was time to go in. "Well, my child," she said to me in a tone which made me tremble, "so you are wandering about the country at your age. That is indeed a pity." Then, without waiting for me to answer, she added, "Go and wait for me. Tell them to give you some breakfast. After Mass I will come and talk to you." Louise Eleonore de Varennes was a young lady who belonged to the house of La Tour de Pile, an ancient and noble family of Vevey, a town in the canton of Vaud. When very young she had married Monsieur de Varennes, of the house of Loye, the eldest son of Monsieur de Viardin, of Lausanne. This marriage, which proved childless, was not a happy one, and Madame de Varennes, driven by some domestic grief, seized the opportunity of the presence of King Victor Amadeus at Evian to cross the lake and throw herself at the feet of this prince, thus abandoning her husband, her family, and her country, through a piece of folly which much resembled mine, and which she, like myself, has had ample time to lament. The king, who was fond of posing as a zealous Catholic, took her under his protection, and settled her on an annuity of 1,500 Piedmontese livres, a tolerably large sum for a prince who, as a rule, was little inclined to be generous. Afterwards, finding that he was reported to be in love with her, in consequence of the manner in which he had received her, he sent her to Annecy under the escort of a detachment of his guards, where, under the spiritual guidance of Michel Gabriel de Bernay, titular bishop of Geneva, she renounced the Protestant faith in the convent of the Visitation. She had been 6 years in Annecy when I arrived there, and was 28 years of age, having been born with the century. Her beauty was of the kind which lasts, consisting rather in the expression than the features. Besides, hers was still in its first brilliancy. She had a caressing and tender air, a gentle look, an angelic smile, a mouth like my own, ashen grey hair of rare beauty, which she wore in a careless fashion, which gave her a very piquant appearance. She was small of stature, even short, somewhat dumpy, although not disagreeably so. But a more beautiful head and bosom, more beautiful hands and arms, could not have been seen. Her education had been very peculiar. Like myself, she had lost her mother at her birth, and receiving instruction indiscriminately, just as it happened to offer itself, she had learnt a little from her governess, a little from her father, a little from her masters, and a great deal from her lovers, especially from one Monsieur de Tavelle, who, being a man of taste and learning, adorned the object of his affections with his own excellences. But so many different kinds of instruction impeded each other, and as she pursued her studies without any regular system, her naturally sound understanding was by no means improved. Thus, although she knew something about the principles of philosophy and physics, she still preserved her father's taste for empirical medicine and alchemy. She prepared elixirs, tinctures, balsams, and magisteries, a powder to which sovereign virtues were formerly attributed. She claimed to possess secret remedies. Quacks, profiting by her weakness, got hold of her, pestered her, ruined her, and in the midst of crucibles and drugs squandered her intellect, her talents, and her charms, with which she might have graced the highest society. But although vile rascals abused her ill-directed education in order to obscure the light of her reason, her excellent heart stood the test and always remained the same. Her loving and gentle character, her sympathy with the unfortunate, her inexhaustible goodness, her cheerful, frank, and open disposition never changed. And even when old age came upon her, surrounded by want, suffering, and calamities of all kinds, the calmness of her beautiful soul preserved for her to the end of her life all the gaiety of her happiest days. Her errors were due to an inexhaustible fund of activity which needed incessant occupation. She wanted no intrigues like other women, but enterprises to direct and carry out. She was born to take part in important affairs. In her place, Madame de Longueville would have been a mere intriguer. In the place of Madame de Longueville, she would have governed the state. Her talents were misplaced, and that which would have brought fame to her in a more exalted position proved her ruin in that in which she lived. In everything which was within the reach of her mental capacity, she always enlarged her plan in her head and saw its object magnified, the result of this being that she employed means better proportioned to her views than her strength. She failed through the fault of others, and when her project failed to succeed, she was ruined, where others would scarcely have lost anything. This eagerness for business, which did her so much harm, was at least of great service to her in her monastic retreat, in that it prevented her from settling there for the rest of her life, as she had intended. The regular and simple life of the nuns, the idle gossip of the parlour, could not possibly be agreeable to a mind which was continually in movement, and which, inventing new systems every day, required freedom in order to devote itself to them. The good Bishop of Bernay, though not so clever as François de Sales, resembled him in many points, and Madame de Varennes, whom he called his daughter, and who resembled Madame de Chantal in many other points, might have resembled her even in her retirement, had not the idle life of a convent been distasteful to her. François de Sales was the Bishop of Geneva, 1567 to 1622. Madame de Chantal was a lady distinguished for her great piety, the foundress of the Order of the Visitation. She was canonized by Clement XIII. It was not from want of zeal that this amiable woman did not devote herself to the trifling exercises of devotion, which appeared suitable to a new convert living under the guidance of a prelate. Whatever may have been the motive that induced her to change her religion, she was certainly sincere in that which she had embraced. She may have repented of having taken the step. Certainly she never wished to retrace it. She not only died a good Catholic, she proved herself one during her lifetime. And I, who believe that I have read her inmost soul, dare to affirm that it was solely owing to a horror of affectation that she never played the devotee in public. Her piety was too genuine for her to make a show of devotion. But this is not the place to discuss her principles. I shall have other opportunities of speaking of them. Those who deny the sympathy of souls may explain, if they can, how, from the first interview, from the first word, from the first look, Madame de Varennes inspired me not only with the liveliest feelings of attachment, but with a perfect confidence which has never belied itself. Granted that my sentiments for her were really love, which will at least appear doubtful to those who follow the history of our relations, how came it that this passion was from the outset accompanied by the feelings which at least inspires? Peace of heart, calm, cheerfulness, confidence, trust. How was it that when for the first time I approached an amiable, refined, and dazzlingly beautiful woman, a lady of higher position than my own, the like of whom I had never addressed, upon whom my destiny in a manner depended, according as she interested herself more or less on my behalf, how came it, I repeat, that in spite of all this I immediately felt as free and completely at my ease as if I had been perfectly certain of pleasing her? How was it that I did not for a single moment experience a feeling of embarrassment, timidity, or awkwardness? Naturally bashful and easily put out of countenance, knowing nothing of the world, how was it that from the first day, from the first moment, I was able to assume with her the easy manners, the tender language, the familiar tone which prevailed between us 10 years later, when our close intimacy had made it natural? Is it possible to love, I do not say without desires, for those I had, but without jealousy? Does not one at least wish to learn from the object of one's affection whether one is loved in return? It has no more occurred to me in the course of my life ever to ask her this question than to ask myself whether I loved her, and she has never shown greater curiosity in regard to myself. There was certainly something singular in my feelings for this charming woman, and in the course of the narrative the reader will find unexpected singularities. It was a question what was to become of me, and, in order to discuss my future more at leisure, she kept me to dinner. It was the first meal in my life at which my appetite failed me, and her maid, who waited upon us, said that I was the first traveller of my age and class that she'd ever seen in such a condition. This remark, which did me no harm in the eyes of her mistress, struck home to a great lout who was dining with us, and who devoured by himself quite a respectable dinner for six. As for myself, I was in a state of rapture which did not allow me to eat. My heart fed upon an entirely new feeling, with which my whole being was filled, and which left me no inclination for doing anything else. Madame de Varennes wanted to know the details of my little history, and in relating them I recovered all the fire and vivacity which I had lost during my apprenticeship. The more I interested this excellent soul in my favour, the more she lamented the lot to which I intended to expose myself. She did not venture to advise me to return to Geneva. In her position that would have been an act of treason to the Catholic faith. And she knew only too well how she was watched, and how her words were weighed. But she spoke to me so touchingly of my father's affliction, that it was easy to see that she would have approved of my going to console him. She did not know how strongly, without knowing it, she was pleading against herself. I think I have already said that my mind was made up. The more eloquent and persuasive her words, the more they went to my heart, the less I was able to make up my mind to separate from her. I felt that to return to Geneva would be to put an almost insurmountable barrier between herself and me, unless I again took the step which I had already taken, and by which it was better to abide once and for all. I accordingly remained firm. Madame de Warenne's, seeing that her efforts were unavailing, did not persist in them, to avoid compromising herself, but she said to me with a look of compassion, "Poor little one, you must go where God calls you, but when you are grown up, you will think of me." I believe she herself had no idea how cruelly this prediction was to be fulfilled. The difficulty was great. How was I, young as I was, to find a livelihood so far from home? Having served scarcely half my apprenticeship, I was very far from knowing my trade. Even if I had known it, I should have been unable to earn a living by it in Savoy, for the country was too poor to support the arts. The lout who was eating our dinners for us, being obliged to stop to give his jaws a rest, made a proposal which he declared was inspired by heaven, but which, to judge from its results, was rather inspired by the opposite place. This proposal was that I should go to Turin, where I should find spiritual and bodily support in a hospice established for the instruction of catechumens, until, after I had been received into the bosom of the church, I should find suitable employment by the kindness of the charitable. "As to the expenses of his journey," continued my friend, "his lordship the bishop will no doubt be kind enough to provide for them, if Madame suggests this holy work to him. And doubtless, Madame la Baronne," he added, bending over his plate, "who is so charitable, will also be eager to contribute towards them." I found the idea of so much charity very distasteful. I was sick at heart, and said nothing. Madame de Warenne's, without embracing the suggestion as eagerly as it was offered, contented herself with replying that everyone ought to do good to the best of his power, and that she would speak to the bishop about it. But my confounded friend, who had little interest of his own in the matter, and was afraid that she might not speak of it exactly as he wished, hastened to warn the almoners, and worked upon the good priests so cleverly that when Madame de Warenne's, who feared the journey for me, wished to speak about it to the bishop, she found that everything had been arranged, and he immediately handed her over the money destined for my humble travelling expenses. She did not venture to insist upon my remaining, for I was approaching an age when a woman of her own years could not, with propriety, express a desire to keep a young man with her. My journey being thus arranged by those who took charge of me, I was obliged to submit, and I even did so without much reluctance. Although Turin was further than Geneva, I judged that, being the capital, it was more closely connected with Annecy than a town of different faith and in a foreign land. And besides, as I was setting out in obedience to Madame de Warenne's, I considered myself as remaining under her guidance, and that was more than living in her neighbourhood. Lastly, the idea of a long journey flattered my fondness for roaming, which was already beginning to declare itself. It appeared to me a fine thing to cross mountains at my age, and to elevate myself above my comrades by the whole height of the Alps. There is a charm in seeing different countries which a Genovese can scarcely ever resist. I therefore gave my consent. My lout intended to set out in 2 days with his wife, and I was entrusted to their care. My funds, which Madame de Warenne's had augmented, were handed over to them. She also gave me privately a little pocket money and much good advice. And, on the Wednesday in Passion Week, we set out on our journey. On the day after I left Annecy, my father arrived, having followed on my track with his friend Monsieur Rival, a watchmaker like himself, a talented and even a witty man, who wrote better verses than La Motte, and was almost as good a speaker. In addition, he was a thoroughly good fellow, but his misplaced taste for literature led to no other result than sending one of his sons on the stage. These gentlemen saw Madame de Varennes and contented themselves with lamenting my lot, instead of following and overtaking me, as they could easily have done, since they were on horseback while I was on foot. My uncle Bernard had done the same. He had gone as far as Confignon, whence he returned to Geneva, after he heard that I was at Annecy. It seemed as if my relations were in league with my unlucky star to hand me over to the destiny which awaited me. My brother had been lost through similar negligence, and so completely that it has never been known what became of him. My father was not only a man of honour, he was a man of proved uprightness, and he had one of those strong souls which are capable of great virtues. In addition to which, he was a good father, especially towards myself. He loved me very tenderly, but he also loved his pleasures, and since I had lived apart from him, other tastes had rendered his paternal affection somewhat lukewarm. He had married again at Nyon, and although his wife was no longer of an age to present me with brothers, she had relations. This created another family, other aims, a new establishment, which no longer so frequently recalled the memory of myself. My father was growing old, and had nothing to live upon, but my brother and myself had a small property from our mother, the interest of which could be claimed by my father during our absence. This idea did not present itself to him directly, and by no means prevented him from doing his duty, but it exercised a secret influence without his being aware of it, and sometimes moderated his zeal, which he would have pushed further had it not been for that. That, I believe, was the reason why, having originally gone to Annecy to find me out, he did not follow me as far as Chambéry, where he would have been morally certain to find me. That, again, was the reason why, when I went to pay him a visit, as I frequently did after my flight, he always received me with the caresses of a father, but without making any serious efforts to keep me with him. This behaviour on the part of a father, whose tenderness and uprightness I knew so well, led me to reflections upon myself, which have in no small degree contributed to keep my heart in a healthy condition. From these I have drawn the great moral lesson, perhaps the only one of any practical value, to avoid those situations of life which bring our duties into conflict with our interests, and which show us our own advantage in the misfortunes of others. For it is certain that in such situations, however sincere our love of virtue, we must, sooner or later, inevitably grow weak without perceiving it, and become unjust and wicked in act, without having ceased to be just and good in our hearts. This principle, deeply imprinted on the bottom of my heart, which, although somewhat late, in practice guided my whole conduct, is one of those which have caused me to appear a very strange and foolish creature in the eyes of the world, and above all amongst my acquaintances. I have been reproached with wanting to pose as an original and different from others. In reality, I have never troubled about acting like other people or differently from them. I sincerely desired to do what was right. I withdrew, as far as it lay in my power, from situations which opposed my interests to those of others, and might consequently inspire me with a secret, though involuntary, desire of injuring them. 2 years ago, my Lord Marshal wanted to put my name in his will. I strongly opposed this. I told him that I would not for the world know that my name was down in anyone's will, least of all in his. He gave in, but insisted upon bestowing upon me a pension for life, to which I offered no opposition. It will be said that I gain by this alteration. That may be so, but I know, O father and benefactor, that if I unhappily survive you, in losing you I have everything to lose and nothing to gain. That, in my opinion, is the true philosophy, the only philosophy which is really suited for the human heart. I am more impressed every day by its profound solidity, and in all my recent writings I have presented it under various aspects. But the public is superficial, and has not known how to recognize it. If, after I have finished my present task, I live long enough to undertake another, I propose to give in the sequel to Emile so attractive and striking an example of this maxim that the reader will be compelled to notice it. See the New Héloïse, Part 3, Letter 20. But enough reflections for a traveller. It is time to continue my journey. I found it more agreeable than I had expected, and my lout was not so sulky as he looked. He was a man of middle age who wore his black hair, which was beginning to grow grey, in a queue. He looked like a grenadier, had a strong voice, was pretty cheerful, could walk well and eat better, and practised all sorts of trades, for want of knowing any. I believe he had proposed to establish some kind of manufactory at Annecy, and Madame de Warennes had not failed to approve of the idea. It was in order to make the attempt to gain the minister's approval also that, well furnished with money, he was making the journey to Turin. Our friend possessed a talent for intrigue, always making himself agreeable to the priests. And while showing great eagerness to serve them, he had caught from their school a certain pious jargon, of which he made incessant use, and boasted of being a great preacher. He even knew one passage of the Bible in Latin, and, as he repeated it 1,000 times a day, it was as if he had known 1,000. He was seldom short of money when he knew that others had any in their purse. He was rather clever than a rogue, and when he recited his Capucinade in the tone of a recruiting officer, he resembled Peter the Hermit preaching the Crusade, sword in hand. Capucinade are insipid discourses upon religious matters, like those of the Capucin friars. As for his wife, Madame Sabrin, she was a good woman enough, who was quieter during the day than at night. As I always slept in their room, her noisy sleeplessness often woke me, and would have kept me awake still more, if I had known the reason of it. But I had not the least suspicion, and my stupidity on this point left the duty of instructing me to nature alone. I proceeded gaily on my way with my pious guide and his lively companion. No mishap disturbed my journey. I was happier in body and mind than I have ever been in my life. Young, vigorous, in perfect health, without a care, full of confidence in myself and others, I was enjoying that short but precious moment of life when its expansive fullness, so to speak, enlarges our being in all our sensations and beautifies in our eyes the whole aspect of nature by the charm of our existence. My pleasant restlessness had an object which restrained it and steadied my imagination. I looked upon myself as the work, the pupil, the friend, almost as the lover of Madame de Warennes. The polite things she had said to me, the little caresses which she had bestowed upon me, the tender interest which she had seemed to take in me, her friendly looks, which appeared to me full of love, since they inspired me with that feeling. All this occupied my thoughts during the journey, and plunged me in delicious reveries, undisturbed by any fear or doubt concerning my future. I considered that, in sending me to Turin, they had undertaken to support me there and to find me a suitable situation. I felt that I need not trouble further about myself. Others had undertaken the charge. So I went on my way with light step, freed from this burden. Youthful desires, enchanting hopes, brilliant plans filled my soul. Everything that I saw appeared to assure my early happiness. In the houses I pictured to myself rustic festivities, in the meadows playful romps, on the banks of the rivers baths, walks, fishing. On the trees delicious fruit, under their shade loving tete-a-tetes, on the mountains pails full of milk and cream, a charming idleness, peace, simplicity, and the pleasure of going I knew not where. In short, nothing met my eyes without conveying to my heart some attraction of enjoyment. The grandeur, the variety, the real beauty of the sight around me rendered this attraction worthy of reason. Even vanity claimed its share. It appeared to me an honour beyond my years to visit Italy while still so young, to have already seen so much of the world, to follow Hannibal across the mountains. Besides this, we frequently halted at good inns. I had a good appetite and plenty to satisfy it, for it was really not worth while to deny myself anything, since my own meals were nothing in comparison with those of Monsieur Sabrin. During the whole course of my life, I never remember a time when I have been so completely free from care and trouble as during the 7 or 8 days of our journey. For Madame Sabrin's rate of travelling, by which we were obliged to regulate our own, made it nothing but a long walk. This recollection has left me the liveliest taste for everything connected with it, especially for mountains and walks. I have never journeyed on foot, except in my younger days, and then always with the greatest pleasure. Duties, business, luggage soon obliged me to play the gentleman and take a carriage. Gnawing cares, perplexities, and discomfort got in with me. And from that moment, instead of feeling, as before, nothing but the pleasure of travelling, my only anxiety was to reach the end of my journey. For a long time I endeavoured to find in Paris two companions of the same tastes as myself, willing to spend 50 louis of their money and a year of their time upon a walking tour through Italy with me, with only a single lad to carry our travelling bags. Many appeared enchanted with the idea, but in reality considered it as nothing but a castle in the air, only fit to talk about, without any idea of putting it into execution. I remember that Diderot and Grimm, with whom I once discussed the idea with enthusiasm, at last became enamoured of it. Once I thought the matter settled, but it all ended in their wanting to make a journey on paper, in which Grimm found nothing so delightful as making Diderot commit a number of impieties and handing me over to the Inquisition in his stead. My regret at arriving so soon at Turin was lessened by the pleasure of seeing a large city, and by the hope of soon playing a part worthy of myself. For already the fumes of ambition were mounting to my brain. Already I regarded myself as infinitely raised above my former condition of apprentice, and I was far from suspecting that, in a short time, I was destined to fall far below it. Before I continue, I must excuse or justify myself to the reader for the trivial details into which I have already entered, or into which I shall enter in the course of my narrative, and which in his eyes can have no interest. The task which I have undertaken, of showing myself completely without reserve to the public, requires that nothing that concerns myself shall remain obscure or hidden, that I shall keep myself continually before its eyes, that it shall accompany me in all the errors of my heart, into all the secret corners of my life, that it shall not lose sight of me for a single instant, for fear that, if it finds in my narrative the least gap, the least blank, it may ask, what was he doing during that time, and accuse me of unwillingness to tell all? My writings expose me sufficiently to the spite of mankind, without my exposing myself to it still more by my silence. My little pocket money was gone. I had chattered, and my guides were not slow to take advantage of my indiscretion. Madame Sabin managed to get everything from me, even a small piece of ribbon covered with silver, which Madame de Warens had given me for my little sword, and which I regretted more than anything else. The sword itself would have remained in their hands if I had resisted less firmly. They had faithfully defrayed my expenses during the journey, but they had left me nothing. I reached Turin without clothes, without money, without linen, and was obliged to leave entirely to my merits the honour of the fortune I was going to make. I had some letters. I presented them, and was immediately conducted to the hospice for catechumens, to be instructed in the religion with which I was to purchase my livelihood. On my arrival I beheld a large gate with iron bars, which was double-locked behind me as soon as I had passed through it. This introduction struck me as more imposing than agreeable, and was beginning to afford me food for reflection, when I was conducted into a tolerably large room. All its furniture consisted of a wooden altar, surmounted by a large crucifix at the end of the room, in front of which stood 4 or 5 chairs, also made of wood, which looked as if they had been polished, but in reality had become shiny merely from constant use and rubbing. In this assembly room were 4 or 5 frightful villains, my fellow students, who seemed to be rather the devil's constables than aspirants to the honour of sons of God. two of these rascals were Slavonians, who called themselves Jews or Moors, and as they confessed to me, spent their life in wandering through Spain and Italy, embracing Christianity and submitting to be baptized, where they found it worth their while. Another iron door was then thrown open, which divided into two a large balcony running along the courtyard. Through this door, our sisters entered, catechumens who, like myself, were to be born again, not by means of baptism, but by a solemn abjuration of their faith. They were certainly the greatest sluts and the most disgusting vagabonds who ever contaminated the sheepfold of the Lord. Only one appeared to me pretty and attractive. She was about my own age, perhaps 2 or 3 years older. She had roguish eyes, which sometimes met mine. This inspired me with a desire to make her acquaintance, but during nearly 2 months, which she spent in the house after my arrival, she had already been there 3 months, I found it absolutely impossible to speak to her, so strictly had she been recommended to the care of our old jailoress, and so carefully was she watched by the holy missionary, who laboured with more zeal than diligence to convert her. She must have been extremely dull, although she did not appear so, for never did tuition require so long a time. The holy man always found her unfit for the act of abjuration. But she grew weary of her confinement, and declared that she wanted to leave, Christian or no Christian. They were obliged to take her at her word, while she still showed herself ready to become one, for fear she might become refractory and refuse. The little community was assembled in honour of the newcomer. A short address was delivered to us, in which I was exhorted to consent to respond to the favour which God extended to me, while the others were invited to pray for me and edify me by their example. After this, our virgins returned to their seclusion, and I had time to meditate with astonishment upon my own situation, to my heart's content. Next morning we were again assembled to receive instruction, and then for the first time I began to reflect upon the step I was going to take, and upon the circumstances which had led me to do so. I have said, I repeat it, and shall perhaps repeat it again, as I am daily more convinced of its truth, that if ever a child received a sensible and sound education, it was myself. I belonged to a family which was distinguished by its manner from the common people. From all my relations I had learnt nothing but lessons of wisdom, and had had honourable examples before my eyes. My father, although fond of pleasure, was not only a man of strict integrity, but of considerable religious feeling. A man of gallantry in the world, and a Christian at heart, he had early instilled into me the sentiments which he felt. Of my 3 aunts, who were all prudent and virtuous, the 2 eldest were pious. The youngest, a girl full of grace, talent, and good sense, was perhaps even more pious, although she made less show of it. From the bosom of this estimable family I went to Monsieur Lambercier, who, though a churchman and preacher, was at heart a believer, and nearly always practised what he preached. He and his sister, by gentle and judicious training, cultivated the principles of piety which they found in my heart. These worthy people, with this object, employed means so sincere, so prudent, and so sensible, that far from being wearied by their preaching, I always felt deeply affected by it, and formed the best resolutions, which I rarely forgot to carry out when I thought of them. In the case of my aunt Bernard, her piety was somewhat more distasteful to me, because she made a trade of it. While serving my apprenticeship, I scarcely thought of it, without, however, changing my views. I never came into contact with any young people who might have corrupted me. I became vagabond, but not dissipated. I consequently knew as much about religion as was possible for a child of my age. I even knew more, for why should I conceal my thoughts? My childhood was not that of a child. I always felt and thought as a man. It was only when I grew up that I re-entered the class of ordinary individuals. As a child I did not belong to it. The reader will laugh to find me modestly representing myself as a prodigy, So be it. But when he has laughed sufficiently, let him find a child who, in his sixth year, is so attracted, interested, and carried away by romances as to shed hot tears over them. Then I shall feel that my vanity is ridiculous, and will confess that I am wrong. If I have said that we ought not to speak about religion to children, if we wish them to possess any, and further, that they are incapable of knowing God, even according to our ideas, I have drawn this conviction from my observations, not from my own experience, for I knew that no conclusion could be drawn from it in regard to others. Find me Jean-Jacques Rousseau's of 6 years old, and speak to them of God when they are seven. I will guarantee that you run no risk. I think it will be admitted that, in the case of a child, and even of a man, to have religion means to follow that in which he is born. This faith is sometimes lessened, rarely enlarged. Dogmatic belief is one of the fruits of education. Besides this general principle which attached me to the religious creed of my fathers, I had the aversion for Catholicism peculiar to our village, which represented it as a frightful idolatry, and painted its priests in the blackest colours. This feeling was so strong in me that at first I never looked into the inside of a church, never met a priest in a surplice, never heard the processional bell, without a shudder of terror and alarm, which soon left me in the towns, but has often come upon me again in country parishes, more like those where I had first felt it. It is true that this impression contrasted singularly with the recollections of the caresses which the priests of the environs of Geneva were fond of bestowing upon children of the city. While the bell announcing supreme unction alarmed me, the bell for Mass and Vespers reminded me of breakfast, collation, fresh butter, fruit, and milk food. Monsieur de Pontvert's good dinner still produced a great effect. Thus I had easily driven all such thoughts out of my mind. Seeing papism only in its connection with amusement and good living, I had readily accustomed myself to the idea of living in its midst, but the idea of solemnly going over to the Church of Rome had only presented itself to me for a moment, as possible in a distant future. At the present moment it was no longer possible to deceive myself. I saw with horror the kind of consent which I had given, and its inevitable consequences. The future neophytes around me were not calculated to sustain my courage by their example, and I could not conceal from myself that the holy work, which I intended to carry out, was in the main the action of a bandit. For, young as I was, I felt that, whatever religion might be the true one, I was going to sell my own, and that, even though I made a good choice, in the bottom of my heart I should lie to the Holy Spirit and deserve the contempt of men. The more I thought of it, the more indignant I became with myself, and I sighed over the destiny which had brought me to this pass, as if this destiny had not been my own work. There were moments when these reflections became so strong that, if I had found the door open for a moment, I should certainly have run away. But this was impossible, and my resolution was not strong enough. Too many secret desires combated it not to overcome it. Besides, my fixed determination not to return to Geneva, shame, the difficulty of crossing the mountains again, the embarrassment of finding myself far from my country, without friends and without resources, all these feelings combined to make me regard my prickings of conscience as a too tardy repentance. I pretended to reproach myself for what I'd done, in order to excuse what I was going to do. While aggravating the errors of the past, I regarded the future as their necessary result. Instead of saying to myself, "Nothing is done yet, and you can be innocent if you wish," I said, "Sigh for the crime of which you have made yourself guilty, and which you have made it necessary for yourself to carry out." In fact, what uncommon strength of mind would have been necessary, at my age, in order to recall everything that I had hitherto promised or given hopes of, to break the bonds which I had placed upon myself, to declare boldly that I desired at all risks to continue in the religion of my fathers. Such vigour was not natural to one of my age, and it is not very probable that it would have succeeded. Things had gone too far for them not to feel ashamed if they did not succeed, and the greater my resistance, the more they would have felt themselves bound, by some means or other, to overcome it. The sophism which ruined me is that common to most men who complain of want of strength, when it is already too late to make use of it. Virtue only becomes difficult by our own fault. If we could always be prudent, we should rarely need to be virtuous. But inclinations, easily surmountable, hurry us along without resistance. We yield to trifling temptations, the danger of which we despise. Imperceptibly we fall into perilous situations, from which we could easily have protected ourselves, but from which we can no longer extricate ourselves without heroic efforts which appall us. And at last we fall into the abyss, reproaching God. Why hast thou made me so weak? But in spite of ourselves, he replies to our consciences, I have made you too weak to save yourself from the abyss, because I made you strong enough not to fall into it. I did not exactly resolve to become a Catholic, but seeing the time still far off, I profited by the occasion to accustom myself gradually to the idea, and in the meantime I hoped for some unforeseen circumstance which would get me out of the difficulty. In order to gain time, I resolved to make the best defence of which I was capable, but soon my vanity relieved me from thinking of my resolution, and as soon as I observed that I sometimes embarrassed those who desired to instruct me, that was sufficient to make me endeavour to floor them altogether. I even exhibited ridiculous eagerness in this undertaking. For while they were working upon me, I wanted to work upon them. I honestly believed that I had only to convince them to make them turn Protestants. Consequently, they did not find in me nearly as much tractability as they had expected, either in regard to my knowledge or goodwill. Protestants are generally better instructed than Catholics. This is only natural. The doctrine of the one requires discussion, that of the other, submission. The Catholic is obliged to embrace the decision that is put before him. The Protestant must learn to decide for himself. This was well known, but no great difficulties were expected for persons of experience from one of my age and position. Besides, I had not yet received my first communion, nor received the instructions connected with it. That, too, was known. But what they did not know was that, to make up for this, I had been well taught at Monsieur Lambercier's, and that, in addition, I had by me a little storehouse, very inconvenient for these gentlemen, in the history of the Church and the Empire, which, while living with my father, I had learnt almost by heart, and since then almost forgotten, but which came back to me in proportion as the dispute grew warmer. A little, old, but somewhat venerable priest held the first meeting of all of us together. For my companions this meeting was rather a catechism than a discussion, and he had more to do with instructing them than with removing their objections. In my own case it was different. When my turn came, I stopped him at every point, and spared him no single difficulty which I was able to throw in his way. This protracted the meeting, and made it very tedious for those who were present. My old priest spoke much, grew excited, wandered from his subject, and got himself out of the difficulty by declaring that he did not know French well. The next day, for fear that my indiscreet objections might give offence to my companions, I was put into another room with another priest, who was younger and a good speaker, that is to say, a coiner of fine phrases, and satisfied with himself, if ever a teacher was. I did not, however, allow myself to be too much cowed by his imposing manner, and feeling that, after all, I was able to hold my own, I proceeded to answer him with tolerable confidence, and to press him on all sides to the best of my ability. He thought to overwhelm me with St. Augustine, St. Gregory, and the other fathers, but found to his incredible surprise that I handled all the fathers nearly as readily as he did. Not that I'd ever read them, as neither, perhaps, had he, but I remembered several passages out of my Le Sueur, and as soon as he quoted one, without stopping to dispute it, I answered it by another from the same father, which frequently caused him considerable embarrassment. However, in the end he gained the victory, for two reasons. In the first place, he was the stronger, and feeling that I was, so to speak, at his mercy, I correctly judged, young as I was, that it would not do to press him, to drive him to extremities. For I saw clearly enough that the little old priest had conceived no great affection for myself or my learning. In the second place, the young priest was an educated man, while I was not. This caused him to employ, in his manner of argument, a method which I was unable to follow, and as soon as he felt himself pushed by some unforeseen objection, he put it off until the next day, declaring that I was wandering from the point. Sometimes he even refused to accept my quotations, declaring that they were false, and, offering to go and fetch the book for me, defied me to find them. He felt that he did not risk much, and that, with all my borrowed learning, I was not sufficiently experienced in handling books, and did not know enough Latin to find a passage in a large volume, even though I might be certain that it was there. I even suspected him of making use of the same dishonesty of which he accused our ministers, and of sometimes inventing passages in order to extricate himself from a difficulty which embarrassed him. While these petty disputes about trifles lasted, and the time was spent in arguing, mumbling prayers, and doing nothing, a disgusting little adventure happened to me, which very nearly turned out very badly for me. There is no soul so vile, no heart so barbarous, that it is not susceptible of some kind of attachment. One of the two vagabonds who called themselves Moors conceived an affection for me. He was fond of accosting me, talked to me in his jargon, rendered me slight services, sometimes gave me part of his food, and frequently kissed me with an ardour which was very annoying to me. In spite of the natural alarm which I felt at his gingerbread face, decorated with a long scar, and his inflamed countenance, which appeared more furious than tender, I endured his kisses, saying to myself, "The poor fellow has conceived a lively friendship for me. I should be wrong to repulse him." He gradually began to take greater liberties, and sometimes made such curious proposals to me that I thought he was mad. One night he wanted to sleep with me. I refused, saying that my bed was too small. He pressed me to go to his, but I again refused, for the wretch was so dirty and stunk so strongly of chewed tobacco that he made me quite sick. Early on the following morning, we were both alone in the assembly room. He recommenced his caresses, but with such violent movements that it became quite alarming. At last he wanted to take the most disgusting liberties with me, and taking hold of my hand, tried to make me take the same with him. I uttered a loud cry, and, jumping back, freed myself from him. And, without exhibiting anger or indignation, for I had not the least idea what it was all about, I expressed my surprise and disgust so energetically that he left me where I was. But while he was finishing his efforts, I saw something white, like glue, shoot towards the fireplace and fall upon the ground, which turned my stomach. I rushed upon the balcony, more moved, more troubled, more frightened than I'd ever been in my life, and prepared to find myself ill. I could not understand what had been the matter with the wretch. I believed that he was attacked by epilepsy or some other madness even more terrible. And in truth I knew nothing more hideous for any cold-blooded person to see than such filthy and dirty behaviour, and a frightful countenance inflamed by brutal lust. I have never seen another man in a similar condition. But if we are like it when we are with women, their looks must certainly be bewitched, for them not to feel disgusted at us. I was in a great hurry to go and tell everyone what had just happened to me. Our old intendant bade me hold my tongue. But I saw that my story had greatly affected her, and I heard her mutter, "Can malade, bruta bestia," cursed dog, brute beast. Not understanding why I ought to hold my tongue, I went my own way in spite of her prohibition, and I talked so much that the next day one of the governors came at an early hour to administer a sharp reproof to me, accusing me of compromising the honour of a holy house, and of making a great fuss about a trifle. He spun out his lecture by explaining to me many things of which I was ignorant, but which he did not believe he was teaching me, for he was convinced that I had defended myself because I was unwilling to consent, not because I did not know what the Moor wanted from me. He told me gravely that it was an action forbidden as highly immoral, the desire of which, however, was not an affront to the person who was the object of it, and that there was no need to be so annoyed at having been considered worthy of affection. He told me plainly that he himself, during his youth, had had the same honour paid to him, and that, having been surprised when he was not in a condition to offer any resistance, he had not found it particularly painful. He was so shameless as to make use of plain language, and imagining that the reason of my resistance was the fear of pain, he assured me that I need have no fear, and that I ought not to be alarmed where there was no reason for it. I listened to this wretch with an astonishment, which was increased by the fact that he did not speak for himself, but only appeared to be instructing me for my good. The subject appeared to him so simple that he did not even attempt to ensure privacy. And our conversation was heard by a third party, in the person of an ecclesiastic who seemed no more frightened by it than himself. This air of naturalness so imposed upon me that I was convinced that it was no doubt a custom recognized in the world, as to which I had not had the opportunity of being instructed sooner. This made me listen without anger, but not without disgust. The image of what had happened to me, but above all of what I had seen, remained so deeply impressed upon my memory that, when I thought of it, I still felt disgusted. Without knowing any more about it, my aversion for the thing itself extended to its apologist, and I could not restrain myself sufficiently to prevent him seeing the bad effect of his lessons. He cast a glance at me that was by no means affectionate, and from that time spared no efforts to make my stay in the hospice disagreeable. He succeeded so well that, seeing that there was only one way of getting away, I hastened to take it with as much eagerness as I had up till then exhibited, in order to keep away from it. This adventure assured me for the future against the attempts of the Knights of the Cuff, Chevalier de la Manchette, pederasts. And the sight of people who were supposed to belong to their order, by recalling to my mind the appearance and gestures of my frightful Moor, always inspired me with such horror that I had difficulty in concealing it. On the other hand, women, to my mind, gained much by comparison. It appeared to me that I owed them tender feelings and personal homage by way of reparation for the insults of my sex, and the ugliest strumpet became in my eyes an object of adoration when I remembered the false African. As for him, I do not know what may have been said to him. It did not appear to me that anybody, with the exception of Mistress Lorenza, looked upon him less favourably than before. However, he neither accosted nor spoke to me again. 8 days afterwards, he was baptized with great solemnity, dressed in white from head to foot, in token of the purity of his regenerated soul. The next day he left the hospice, and I've never seen him since. My turn came a month later, for it required all that time to procure for the directors of my conscience the honour of a difficult conversion, and I was obliged to examine and go through all the dogmas, in order that my new docility might be triumphantly paraded. At last, sufficiently instructed and sufficiently prepared to satisfy my masters, I was conducted in solemn procession to the Metropolitan Church of St. John, to make a public abjuration of faith, and to receive the accessories of baptism, although I was not really re-baptized. But as the ceremonies are almost the same, it serves to delude the people with the idea that Protestants are not Christians. I was clothed in a grey coat adorned with white frogs. Brandebourgs, espèces d'ornements de broderie ou de galons qui entourent les boutonnières de certains habits. Litrées. Which were used on such occasions. Two men, before and behind me, carried copper basins, which they beat with a key, and into which each threw his alms, in proportion to his piety or the interest which he took in the new convert. Briefly, nothing of the pomp of the Catholic Church was omitted, in order to render the ceremony at once more edifying to the people, and more humiliating for myself. Only the white robe was wanting, which would have been very useful to me, and which was not given to me as to the Moor, seeing that I had not the honour to be a Jew. This was not all. I was next obliged to go to the Inquisition to receive absolution from the crime of heresy, and to re-enter the bosom of the Church with the ceremony to which Henry IV was subjected in the person of his ambassador. The behaviour and look of the Reverend Father Inquisitor were not calculated to remove the secret terror which had seized upon me when I entered the house. After several questions about my belief, my position, and my